You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help.
This is Chris Costa, the Executive Director at the International Spy Museum. Today, we're joined by Professor Kevin King.
Professor King is a native of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. In 2016, he was teaching English at American University of Afghanistan. In August of that year, he was kidnapped at gunpoint with fellow professor Timothy Weeks from Australia. They were held in captivity by the Taliban for more than 3 years and released last year in exchange for three Taliban members. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Chris. Yeah, I'm doing okay. Just like everyone else, stuck in the lockdown. I realize I'm not the only person on the planet that's been inconvenienced by this, but sometimes you feel that way. But other than that, I'm doing pretty good.
Good. You look good, and it's great to hear your voice. And again, thanks for doing this. I can't help thinking, though, but going from captivity, you had a brief respite, and then the pandemic strikes. So
yeah,
lightning struck twice, but of course, everybody's dealing with it, as you say. So what I'd like to do is understand what took you to Afghanistan. What about your career trajectory took you to American University? What brought you to Kabul?
Okay, it's a long story, but I can try to shorten as much as I can. I was teaching, I was living in LA. I was working for like a marketing firm that did research for actually for the film companies. And right around 92, I got laid off and I just kind of didn't know what to do. And I just started teaching in Korea, which a lot of people do. And then from there, I kind of liked that. And I just started bouncing around. It lasted a lot longer than I ever would have expected it to. But at least one thing that I wanted to do with what I laughingly refer to as my life was to see the world. And it gave me a chance to do that. And I was in Korea. I was down in Cambodia for 2 years. I really enjoyed that. And then I came back to the States for a while, actually because my father died in the late 90s. And I taught there for a little bit. And then I went off again. I taught in Saudi Arabia. It wasn't a lot of fun, but it was still interesting. Right. And I get to meet up with the other teachers, and they're all kind of the same. I mean, it's not like I've since gotten a master's degree in international relations, I think. But when you first start out, I think teaching English in a foreign country, it's like joining the French Foreign Legion now. You just, when nothing else is going on, you just jump into it and you go and you see other people that, you know, just didn't have what they wanted to happen in their life. And it was actually kind of interesting. I got a chance to see the world. And I was in Saudi Arabia for a while. And then I had a short time in Japan. The things that I enjoy about traveling is to see how much things are different, how much people are different, and also how much things are the same, how much people are the same. People's emotional lives are very similar all over the world. And just a brief little thing, in when I was living in Japan, I was just there for 3 months, and I had a little apartment, and out one window was Mount Fuji, and it was great. It was a magnificent sight. And but if I turn my head across the street, Denny's. So you think you're going around the world, and you are, but the world comes with you too, especially with globalization. So I ended up there, and I was in Egypt. I really liked that. I was with a contractor, and that was like my real expat job. That's when I really felt like it. I had a real nice apartment and a Jeep Cherokee, and they moved me around to some different locations. What this was I was teaching the Egyptian employees of a U.S. contractor. They had been there since the Camp David Accords, and it was American pilots and American who were training Egyptian pilots, and also the contractors who would be maintaining and repairing the vehicles. But it was the next day I was going to go, and I get an email about a job that I had applied to that I had forgotten about. It was a short term, but it was in Afghanistan, and it was really looked interesting. This wasn't at the university. This was something different, and it was for a project there. And I went and did that, and that was 2007, and things were still pretty calm there. I mean, you could walk around, and they were still pretty calm, although there were some stirrings that you could sense. It was, you know, maybe the security was getting a little tougher.
The question is, could you go to Chicken Street in 2007? That was a sort of a calibration tool. That's the market that many Americans know about in Kabul and many foreigners. Were you able to go to Chicken Street?
Oh, Chicken Street, and what was the other one? But yeah, I know. And yeah, there were some of the places there you could still get the under-the-counter libations, we say. But yeah, I went to Chicken Street. I got some, what do you call the rugs there? The Afghan rugs. Yeah, they're famous for that. And other parts of Chicken Street, and then some of the bars there, the atmosphere, which I'm surprised that never got attacked, but it was still a kind of a nice thing. And that was like only a short time. That was a 2 month job, but I really liked it. Then I just went back to the U.S. for a while to see my mother and my sister, and because I had been out of the country then for 5 years. Then they a second chance to work with the same project arose a little bit later. So in the end of 2007 and 2008, I went back to there for 2 months. I enjoyed that. Then I went back to Thailand. They thought they were going to have a job for me, a little bit more permanent, and that would have been nice because people already were complaining about all the money that was being thrown around. But anyway, I get an email while I'm in Thailand, and it says, the money we thought we had, well, we don't have it. We're sorry. But the woman I was working with is very nice, and she fixed me up, hooked me up with the university. So that was actually my first time I went to the university, and that was 2008. To 2010, and that's when I taught English. I also taught some political science, and that was very quite interesting. I taught a course in like economic and political development, and the students were very good. They were very interesting about it. They enjoyed it, and I enjoyed teaching them. So that takes me to 2010. Then I was at I went back with the old project that I was with for another short term contract, and that would have taken me to like 2012. That was just, and then something came up, and I just kind of roamed the world, and it was in North Iraq, Kurdistan. It's easy to say that. It doesn't quite exist yet, but hopefully it will. And I stayed there for 2 years. Yeah, it was just for a university, nothing connected to America. But I really liked the Kurds. The administration wasn't so great, but I liked the students. And I was there for 2 years. I probably would have stayed, but I needed an operation on my knee. It went fine, but I didn't sign a contract. And then when I asked if they wanted me to come back, and they said they would, but they had to cut the salaries, because right at that time is when the fighting in Syria started out. And all these refugees were piling in, and it was costing the country a little bit of money. So I go to these places, and then they blow up. It's kind of funny. So anyway, after that, I ended up in Libya, believe it or not, between the first fall of Gaddafi. And then there was a little bit of, there was a calm period there. And then the fighting blew up again. But in, during that calm period, I was there in Libya. And I don't know what I expected, but I really liked it. I liked the Libyans. They were very interesting. And it was an interesting place. Wish I could have seen more of it, but I saw a little of it. But then that blew up. And then that job was over. I was teaching English with some British guys on an oil facility. And right there on the beach, I mean, I see the news all the time. And then I went back to Afghanistan.
And what would have been,
okay, go ahead.
No, what year is that, Kevin, when you went back?
That okay.
Was the last time you
2014, the end of 2014, I went back to Afghanistan, to the American University. And I stayed there. I went up. One nice thing about this time, they sent me up to Mazar, which was very nice. I liked it up there, and they actually offered me the chance to stay there. But for some ridiculous reason, I said no. I mean, I kept thinking about that during the captivity. But I was back in Kabul and teaching, and that's when it all started. That's when we were kidnapped on the way home.
So let's just summarize. Mm-hmm. Me, the last time you were in Afghanistan from your first trip in 2007, 2008, the last time you were in Afghanistan started when, before you were captured?
2014 in October.
So, first of all, all your travels, this is a travel log, right? This is
mm-hmm.
a journey. You were in Libya, you were in Japan, you were in Kuwait, you were in Saudi Arabia. So there you are in Afghanistan, you're settling in. You obviously had some affinity for Afghanistan. You're teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There you are in Kabul University. What was the environment like on the ground at the time?
It was a little bit less freedom of movement than it was the first time I was there. You could go out, but you couldn't go out too much. There was just a sense that there have been some killings there, of actually a teacher and a staff member were killed, and so things were muted. But again, I had mixed feelings about it. But I don't know. I guess you just figure, well, it won't happen to me. But things it was nice. It was interesting to go back because when I went back the second time. At the university, I saw students who I had taught English to, and now they were students in the regular university. And it was nice to see them there, and they were moving along. Some were getting scholarships to America, and that was nice, you know, to see that. But things were a little bit more concerned, a little more muted. There was a more awareness of security then.
So what kind of protection did you have? Did you have personal protection when you went home at night? Were you shuttled back and forth to the university? Did you feel safe and secure?
Generally speaking, yes, because I didn't move around that much. We had vans that took us from the university to our guest house and then from the guest house back to the university. It just seemed fairly safe. There were a few we had a safety drill, but I think most, when you go there and it's just, you go through every day and nothing bad happens, you just tend to get in my case, it was a false sense of security. But when this did happen, I was about 9 days away from a 6-week vacation that would have turned into a 7-week vacation because they had a lot of holidays. And my plan was, because my assigned classes would have been finished, and at that point, there would only have been 3 months left on my, 3 weeks left on my contract. And my plan was to take important stuff home and then perhaps not return. But that was 9 days away, but you know, I ended up staying for 3 more years.
So how'd that happen? Like, what happened that morning? Were you together with Timothy Weeks? Were you in a vehicle? Could you kind of walk us through the event?
Sure.
Of that?
Actually, it was in the evening. I had taught in the morning at a special location. And then later that day, I was back at the university. And we were just headed home in the van. And it was just fortunately, Tim and I. And it just, when it got out of the school, you know, there's the big, you know, iron gates and everything. We went out and then it turned the corner. And it just so happened that right there was some Taliban, presumably from the Haqqani network, pulled a van up in front of ours, and they're wearing Afghan military uniforms, which they didn't get a hold of, and they just jumped out with the machine guns and basically told them to open the doors, and they dragged Tim and I out into their van, and then they drove us out.
What were your first impressions? You surmised that they weren't Afghan military.
At first, there was a possibility because we were told that the Afghan military, you know, for reasons of they want their sovereignty and everything, that they were stopping foreigners to make sure they had proper identification. I thought maybe it was that, but when they dragged us out and, you know, threw us into their van and put us down and put, you know, covers over us, it was obvious that this was pretty serious. And I was, but it's kind of a blur, but I was just, you're just traumatized and you're not thinking, at least I was. I mean, you're just sort of blocked to get out. I mean, you just want to stay alive and hope that you'll stay alive. But it was pretty obvious after just a couple seconds that this was very serious.
So did you drive far, Kevin, or did you go to a safe house in Kabul? What happened?
Okay. They drove us out of the city, and they took us to some hill. I'm not sure. Maybe this was when we crossed into Pakistan, but I can't be certain of all this. So overnight, we were just sort of bound and, you know, with our hands behind our back. And they marched us up and down a hill, and then we found a safe house. It would have been maybe on the border, either in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. And that was the next day. And they did feed us. They untied us. And that's when it was, you know, at least you look for good news. But they said, we don't want to kill you. We just want to trade you. And so I hope they would get over pretty quick. But that's what they did. And then they drove us around for a few days. And we'd stay about a month in one place, and then they'd move us to another place for a month. And maybe we'd stay for 3 months here, and then they'd move us to another place. I think the longest we stayed in one place might have been like 6 months, but they didn't seem to want to keep us in one place for very long.
So you were in Pakistan, you think, for the most
part? Again, I thought we were, but then later we found out maybe we weren't. So okay. I think that, you know, I'm not sure on that, but I'm pretty sure that we must have crossed over at some time.
Did you know at the time that the Colemans were also being held?
No, I did not. They talked about it, captors, but no, I didn't know.
What did they tell you about it? Just out of curiosity.
See, that's when I'm trying to think what that. I thought that they were telling us that they had been released or that they were kidnapped after us, which they weren't. They were kidnapped before, but that's all we heard of them. And then they said they were eventually released. As I understand it, they weren't released. They were rescued. But I heard that they had, this woman had had one or two children there, which is, I'm glad she survived that, but that must have been rather difficult under the circumstances.
Right. I mean, yeah. Kate did deliver children in custody, and she was rescued reportedly by the Pakistanis. So that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So let me just ask you a question. What were your conditions like while you, to the extent you're comfortable, what were your conditions like in Afghanistan or in Pakistan while you were in captivity?
It was nothing. I mean, I went for 3 years and 3 months without sitting in a chair. I mean, we were just on the ground with mats, and when it got cold, with blankets. But that was it. I mean, there was just, it wasn't like, you know, Hogan's Hero, you could walk around and in a POW camp. You were just in a house, you know, wood, stone, basic building with, you know, with, you know, floor mats and blankets. And then they'd feed us twice a day.
How was,
yeah, that was it.
From the food, were you accustomed to Afghan?
Well, it wasn't that much. I mean, maybe a plate of rice, which actually would be pretty good. Sometimes we'd get some goat meat, sometimes some eggplant. You know, it was edible, and sometimes it was okay. Sometimes it was decent. And, you know, they wanted to keep us alive. I mean, that's what their job was, to keep us alive until they could get what they wanted from us.
So did you fear for your life while you were in captivity, Kevin?
It would go back and forth. There were times when I just said, realistically, that I won't survive. Because, and later it's different, but it was, they kept, you know, they're, you know, I guess kidnapping is an art. I mean, they know what they're doing. And they could say, you know, you're going to be released in a week, you know, and then, because that went on for 3 years. But I didn't know what it would end. You hope they would end. So there were times when I just felt that it was going to end soon. But they would talk to us, and then there was some guy that just, at the very beginning of it, they said, we're negotiating and we think we're going to work something out. But then other times, you know, it would appear hopeless. And the worst thing, as it kept going, the health of both of us, but me particularly, our health deteriorated. I think neither of us would have survived another 6 months. We both had operations within like 3 months of getting out for hernia. So I don't think we would have survived a whole lot longer. And actually, one more thing. I'm sure that their job, or, you know, their plan was to keep us alive until they could get what they want. But towards the end, it was like I felt that things that were out of their control could have gotten us killed. They, you know, the Afghan army was after them, and we could hear towards the very end, they would hear helicopters at night sometimes, and they'd be shelling whatever village we happened to be living in. And I thought, you know, that we weren't really, they would just drag us and throw us into these tunnels. Another time, in one place we were being held, there was a live scorpion walking around. That could have killed us. So there were things even without their control, even if their fear, you know, their plan was to keep us alive until they can get some prisoners exchanged. There were things that they could not control that might have killed us too. But, you know, you just keep hoping that you'll stay alive.
We'll be right back after this.
And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose Sixth Sense, visit sixthsense.com.
So, Kevin, this might be tough to ask, and again, only answer it if you're comfortable. But I mean, how did you cope, you know, with the idea of losing hope? How did you maintain your sense of being centered? I mean, what were your techniques? Did you have any techniques? Did you build or with the guard?
I don't know, and I can't. I don't know what. Looking back, I don't know. I don't know how to do. I just think it's just the animal will to survive. But I didn't want to think about the effect it was having on my family. I didn't even know at the time that my mother was still alive or not. She died while I was being held. And my sister and everything. I didn't even want to think about that while I was there because it would just be too painful. So I just, again, my approach is just, I just tried to block it out. And, you know, it's like, I just, the only time you feel secure is when you could fall asleep. But I just tried to block it out of my mind and, you know, imagine, you know, hopefully that it would, they would work something out. At that point, my health and everything had deteriorated to the point where I don't know how far I could have gotten. I don't know, you know, you keep thinking we'd climb over the wall or something, but what are you going to find on the other side? You have no idea what's out there. So I don't think I got really despair that it wouldn't last that long, but it definitely, I felt it. And I just stay there and then hopefully I, you know, get over it and just think hopefully something will happen.
Did you have access to any books or a chess set, or did you and Timothy talk or play any mental games per se or charades, anything while you were
okay? Sometimes we did. Sometimes we are, you know. But also there were times when they wouldn't let us talk. They just, you know, we were just like dogs in a kennel, and you know, it wasn't extremely brutal, but the threat of being beaten was always hanging over us. Sometimes they wouldn't want us to talk. We just had to lie there, you know. Looking back on it, I don't know how I survived. And right now, I would just try to fight my, if something like that happened again, I would not, I would rather just get shot before it started. But that was it. Now, they did give us, towards the end, some books, you know, some Islamic books, which were, it's kind of interesting. But other than that, no, nothing even like a chess set. They wouldn't let us have a pen. They wouldn't let us have a piece of paper, nothing.
So did you have an opportunity to develop rapport with some of your captors? Were any of them sympathetic to you?
Yeah, you go back and forth. Some of them, you know, were just kind of brutal because, you know, they were under pressure, you know, from the, you know, they had a job to do and their job was keeping us in line. Some were actually kind of nice. They treated us humanely, but I mean, you know, we were, if you're humane, you know, why do you take people hostage? I remember one, towards the end, there was a guard there, one of the guards who, when he was the first time we'd seen him, and he was very friendly. He always wanted to come in and talk to us about America and about this and things like that. And when he first met us, he asked us, what did you do? In other words, why did the Taliban take you? I said, we didn't do anything. They just took us at random. And they always said, you know, we were teaching Christianity or we worked for the CIA or something. But some were very friendly. There was a young fella there that that was nice to us. I mean, he would take care of us. Once, at one point, we were stuck in a tunnel. And there was hardly any oxygen. I mean, we could breathe, but I could hyperventilate. They had actually gotten Tim some cigarettes because he wanted to smoke. And in this place we were at, there was so little oxygen, he couldn't even light a match. And we were there for, but this young guy came in once, you know, and, you know, he explained that the pipe had been broken. So he fixed the pipe. Now, right then you figure this guy, well, he saved my life. And so that was nice. But, you know, for the most part, it was just, that was their job. And they had to let us know that, you know, don't try anything. They had to, you know, they couldn't loosen up at all because they had to keep us there. Yeah.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it occurred to me when you just mentioned the CIA, clearly you had no relationship with the CIA. You were a teacher, yet if somebody listened to all of the places you've been, like the Haqqani Network or Taliban, did they ever get a sense, did they ever debrief you on your travel and accuse you of being an intelligence officer, for example?
Okay. I don't think so, but one thing you know about that I learned from just roaming around the world, I worked in 10 different countries.
Yeah.
And it's like the whole world's just, different obsessed with America. They love us, they hate us, but they're obsessed with us. It's like we're the, you know, we're the reality show for the whole world, and they think every American's a millionaire, every American works for the CIA, and it's just, we're just people with a job. The only thing that they wanted to know at the very beginning, they were, you know, they wanted to know how much money we made, and again, they thought we were teaching Christianity. I mean, that's the accusation. I don't think any of them really thought we were with the CIA, although they kept asking, because, you know, maybe if I'd had some training, I could have gotten out. But they, for the most part, they realized that we were just teachers, and they were just holding us until they could get what they wanted.
So you were really a pawn in some of the regional politics.
Exactly.
So did one other question, then we can move on beyond captivity, because there's some good news here, or we wouldn't be talking to you. Did you and Timothy ever talk about or speculate about a rescue? And did you have a sense that the United States government was working on your release? Did you have any sense that there was this enterprise that you learned about later when you were released that was very much focused on your recovery?
I wasn't aware of it. I am now, and but at the time I wasn't aware. I'm grateful for the fact that they were able to talk to my sister and, you know, explain what was happening and remind her that, you know, that it was being worked on. But I had no idea what it would amount to. Just a jurisdictional thing. I didn't realize that for the most part it was under the jurisdiction of the FBI, because they treat it as a crime committed against an American citizen in a foreign country. So it was their concern. I did learn later that there were some rescue attempts. I don't know all the details, but apparently once there was, and the guards, the Afghan guards took us and threw us into a tunnel, they would always tell us that it was ISIS, or in their case, what they would say, Daesh, and that they had to protect us from them. And well, you know, yeah, I believe them, but I realize now that one of the times that they were supposedly protecting us from ISIS, they were really, you know, trying to hide us from these rescue attempts. Apparently these rescue attempts got close, but I don't know the details.
Right. I read some references in some of the media accounts. So you never definitively knew exactly what was happening, of course, because your captors wouldn't share information with you. So how did it all end? So you were released in December, like flash forward. How did things happen quickly, or was it drip, drip, drip?
Yeah, a little of both, but it accelerated. Round about, you know, again, they kept moving us around after that rescue attempt, I think would have been like March of 2019. And then they moved us around some other places. And that's, I sort of sensed that it was on its way out. It was still 6 months or so away, but the last couple places they had us, that's when, you know, they were talking about it. They talked about Zalmay Khalilzad.
Khalilzad, right.
And about him moving around and, you know, trying to negotiate something. And they talked about the negotiation, and I got the impression that they thought it's going to happen. Although I got that impression from them, you know, like 2 years before that, but one that back at the very beginning, even like after a year there, they were telling us that the Taliban wants to resolve this, which is nice, but you know, 2 years went by. But toward the last year, the conversation that the guards had with us very often was about who's negotiating with who and where he is and what's going to happen. Problem is, they would, something would happen, you know, like an American military vehicle would run over an IED and get blown up, and that would be a problem. I remember that they quoted Trump saying, you know, we could, you know, bomb them off the map. You know, he got frustrated, and I just wanted to explain to them, well, you know, he grew up in Queens, and that's the kind of trash talk you do there, but, you know, they don't understand that. And I mean, that's exactly what it must be frustrating, because, you know, that they know that by doing things like this, they can hold a country hostage. But there was a lot of talk about things. Sometimes it would look very optimistic and then it would fall. But the last couple of places we were in, they kept talking about it. Once they said it was, I think towards we got out November 19 is when they actually let us go. And I would say through October, you sensed it was a done deal, but you know, darkest hour is just before dawn. And October is when we started getting hit by the Afghan Air Force. And that could have, you could feel these missiles that they were firing down at this place that they were keeping us in. And they would just drag us out and throw us into a tunnel for a while. And again, then move us somewhere else. Then the last place we were in, and it was typical because we were there, and I'm saying to Tim, the third play time this happened, I said, you know, we've been here before, and we had it, but, you know, they rip everything off the floor and the walls and everything, you know. But we've been there before. And the last couple nights, they were putting us in this little tiny room because, again, they were afraid something would happen. But that's when they told us that it was a done deal. They had released some prisoners, and it was just a question of coordinating with Qatar. And they told us, you know, it's going to happen. And then they, for what it's worth, they went out and bought us some new clothes so we'd look good. And that was like one afternoon, I think it was a Tuesday. And they brought us out. And that's when it was kind of clear to me. I mean, I don't want to be certain, but it's obvious because they put us into an antechamber, another room of this place, which we've never done that before. I mean, I would go for months without seeing natural light. And there was a bunch of other Taliban walking around in the yard there. And it just felt like it was going to happen. And we got into a van with them, and they drove us, I don't know, maybe an hour or so to a big field. And then they got out of the field and they put their banners up, you know, the Taliban, blah, blah, you know, to identify themselves. And again, you're still wondering. And what I'll never forget is this image in my mind of, I could hear this, you know, helicopters, but I see the two Blackhawks flying in formation. And that's when I realized that this might actually end. And they did a perimeter. They landed. Our guys came out, walked over to the Taliban. They shook hands with each other. And then we got off and got into the Blackhawk. And that's when it was over.
Wow. And of course, the guys, the first question, they checked on your health, right?
Yes, but, you know, they wanted to make sure who I was. They got my name and everything. But they got us into the Black Hawk and asked us if we need anything. They asked if I could walk, and I could, but not very well. But, you know, we were alive, so I think they had tricked us to get us. And they took us to one other place in another aircraft, and then to a American base in Kandahar, and from there they flew us to Bagram, and that's when the health check came, you know, started. They drew blood and put us into some rooms and everything like that.
And I think that's when you must have had firsthand experience on really how this recovery process works, to include evacuating you from Afghanistan to Germany, where you met the ambassador. You want to share that story?
Yeah, we were in Bagram for about a day and a half, and then they, just to get some basic health coverage like that. And then they flew us to Germany, Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Southwest Germany. It's near a NATO base, and I think the U.S. base. I think that's where a lot of the soldiers would get patched up, both from, you know, from Afghanistan or from Iraq. And I still remember they landed us there, and we get into a van, and the ambassador, Richard Grinnell, was there. And he gave me a folded up flag, and he's, you know, he said, "We were thinking about you the whole time." And I said, "Yeah, I know." And that's what kept me, that's what sustained me. But it was nice that someone was there. I couldn't remember much, but I just still remember the fact that he made the effort to be there and give me the flag. It felt good.
you shared that story with me, Kevin. Thanks for sharing it with our audience. Anyone that suffered through your experience would obviously be emotional, and especially the sense that you were free after your captivity.
Exactly. And
so I'm grateful for you sharing that with us. And the first time, as a matter of fact, so we'll shift to kind of a fun topic. Let's just tell the audience, the first time we met was where you shared with us that story was where?
At the Spine Museum.
That's right. That was fun for us to meet for the first time. And we won't mention names, but there were several folks from that had been working on your case.
Exactly.
That'll remain anonymous. But also that day you met Ambassador Robert O'Brien, the National Security Advisor. Robert made a point of coming over to the Spy Museum just to say hello to you and welcome you back, because you guys hadn't met at that time, right?
No, I was still we got back to the U.S. I did back in December 4th, and it's just sort of moving in and settling down. And then that would have been maybe a month later. I was in D.C. with you, and I met some of the people from the FBI. And that was like the first time that I was sort of, just to get out. It was nice to get out. I enjoyed it there. And I did some sightseeing around D.C. And I stayed on the wharf, which I really liked. It's actually pretty close to the, I can see the Spy Museum from my hotel. And so that was the first time I got to meet with, I met with some of the FBI people that I had known, that I had met with, worked with in Lonsdale.
Yeah.
And I got to see them again, and I got to see you meet yourself and some other people that had worked on the project on me, on getting me out. And it was nice to know that I was a person of interest at that time. And it was nice to have Robert O'Brien come by and, take time out of his schedule.
Well, that says a lot about Robert. We've talked about that. I texted him last week and told him you were going to do a podcast, and he got right back to me and said, tell Kevin I said hello. So is there anything else you want to add? How are you coping now that you're home? We talked a little bit about the pandemic that ties you down.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
Yeah. I just, getting locked down. I mean, it put a damper on things, obviously. But it could, because it's funny, after I met you, actually, I needed, that's when I realized I needed an operation. So that happened in February. And then, it worked fine, but it was successful. And by the time that, the doctor gave me an okay and everything, I went back down to D.C. That would have been about March 1st. And I met with some people in the FBI. I talked to them for a while. I did some more sightseeing. And I was, at that point, it was like I was ready for the world. I was just start living again. And then 2 weeks later, it's going to lockdown. It's loosened up, and that's fine. But, it just coming when it did, it just made things tougher. But, I got my life back, and I went out and got some exercise equipment. So at least I had something to do.
Well, we want to get you back to the Spy Museum when things open up. We're back. Reopened, and you're welcome anytime. Although we do this today virtually, but also the work that was done by the U.S. government on the backside, ensuring that you were recovered and that you had the medical care, the appropriate debriefings, and you're still connected, of course, to the community. They can help you with the unique problems that hostages have to deal with once they're recovered. Anything else you want to add about the hostage takers, the handling, anything else you want to share?
No, I can't think of, I don't, I've talked to the, appropriate government officials about it, and I wish I could remember more to help them more, but, it was just one of those things that, I survived it all, and that's, to me, is the big thing, and I'm glad that I did, and get back up. The medical staff at Bagram and Lonsdale were incredible. They put me back together. And I realize now all the work that the people in the government had done for me, yourself and some others, and that, you know, I that's very humbling for me.
Kevin, thank you for your courage to share the story. Thank you for what you endured and really coming on to tell our listeners and educate them on your experience is really important to us, and we're really grateful. Thanks for sharing your story and sharing your thoughts with our listeners.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, Chris. I really appreciate it. It's nice to speak, and I hope people, you know, enjoy hearing it. And visit the Spy Museum. It's a great place.
Thanks, Kevin.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.